Blog Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
Okay. I know you're excited here, but that's enough. We have guests tonight. Before that, a couple quick announcements. Number one, again, the hurricane that went through a week and a half ago, if they're still needing donations. So if you are so inclined to donate to stuff like that, it would be greatly appreciated. Go through the American Red Cross. That is the best way, the safest way that you can do. If you want to donate, contact American Red Cross and just tell them you want it for the hurricane that went through Florida, and they'll get it to the right spot and right people. Also, 17th, I just found out, is Wife Appreciation Day in America. They have a day set aside for it. You know, I mean, you should appreciate your wife all the time, but it's actually Wife Appreciation Day on the 17th of this month. So, what is it, 10 days from now? So, you know, whatever you do special to appreciate your wife, that's the day for it. It seems silly, but okay, I just wanted to share that with you. Another thing, football starts tonight, NFL season. You all know I'm a football fan, so the NFL season starts tonight, and the Chiefs are playing Detroit. And so, go Chiefs. So, I think that's all the announcements I have to make here. We have a guest. I have been talking about the podcast I heard, it's a month ago now, about Native American grapes and origins and all that stuff. I was excited about the podcast. I really enjoyed it. And I told you that I was going to put up on the Facebook page. I didn't because I wanted to get the guys that were on the podcast on the show and talk with them first, and then I'll put the podcast up. So we talked, 2 weeks ago, I think. Yeah, 2 weeks ago. We talked with Clark Smith, and he was fascinating. But he also mentioned someone two or three times during our interview. Jerry Eisterhold, is it?
It is. Thank you for pronouncing it correctly. You're the third person so far.
Thanks. Jerry Eisterhold is our guest tonight. He is the owner of Terravox Winery, which is located in North Kansas City. And he is also a big, big fan of Native American grapes, and he has a bunch of them growing. So he has been sitting here patiently waiting for me while I've been talking for a while here. Oh, by the way, one more announcement. Mike is not with us tonight. You normally hear him in the background make comments. Mike is not with us. He is under the weather, been sick pretty much all week. Not COVID, I don't believe, because he saw a doctor today, and he didn't say anything about COVID. So I don't think it's COVID, but he's under the weather. He will be back next week. And as far as I know, he'll be on Saturday morning on his Flightline Radio program also from 7 to 9, so check that out, and he'll be back up on that, but he's not with us tonight. So okay, we're all set. Jerry, welcome to All About Wine.
Howdy, thanks.
Yeah, Terravox is located in North Kansas City, and we need to talk about this for a few minutes because I am originally from north of the river in Kansas City, and I can't picture where you're located.
Well, technically, we're in unincorporated Platte County, north of Kansas City. We're on those Los Hills that are that kind of parallel the Missouri River between here and Iowa.
Okay. Now I know just about where you're. So you're south of St. Joe. You're right around Weston, then I would say.
Weston's about 10 minutes from us. We're about midway between St. Joe and downtown Kansas City, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now I know where you are. Yeah. That was tobacco growing country and apple growing country up in there for a number of years. I grew up, you know, with that in that area there. Good for growing, like you say, the grapes and all that. So,
yeah.
Native American grapes. Tell me about Native American grapes. Tell our listeners about Native American grapes. I mean, there are a lot more of them than what people imagine. And they, well, we have the father of Native American grapes. And I've got a blank in my head right now, but you know.
You're talking about T.V. Munson, I think?
Yes, Munson, yeah.
Okay. Well, there were many fathers. But where to begin? I caught in part of your intro that one of your missions is to simplify grapes and wine for your audience, and I unfortunately I think we're heading in the opposite direction. We're trying to confuse people and simplify it. But this little adventure began with just finding a book that the aforementioned Thomas Voldy Munson had written based on the exhibit he had put together for the 1893 Columbia Exposition in Chicago. And in it, he had identified 31 genuses of grapes that grew on the planet. And for those of you who know or don't know horticulture, you have your, you know, within each genus, you have a number of cultivars, such as within Vinifera, you have Chardonnay, Cabernet, Pinot, the stuff that you know, most people are familiar with. And there's another genus called Labrusca where you have Concord and Catawba, you know, some, purely American grapes, where you get Welch's grape juice and Manischewitz and things like that. And they are generally known for their, are described as having a little bit of a foxy, that sort of musty flavor that I guess has come to be known as what grapes taste like. But that's two of them, but there's 29 others.
Wow.
And almost all of them grow here in the Midwest because we're at the overlapping eco zones of the woodlands, the prairies, the Ozark Highlands, the Mississippi Delta. So there's more genetic diversity here in these Native American grapes and freshwater fishes and songbirds so than any other state. So I would say it's intellectual, but it's not exactly intellectual to be out, getting dirty. Munson was also a philosopher, and one of his ideas paralleled something we learned in design school, was that it's one thing to just have a something pop into your head, but until you work it out in the real world, you're not really completing the thought, as it were. So, you put all that stuff together, and that led to the innocent kind of question, like, he, in this book that described hundreds of varietals that he had developed, and he said, oh, this makes a wonderful wine. This makes a great table grape. So you don't really know what that means. Somebody writing back in the 1890s or the early 1900s. So it kind of became a slippery slope to try to track down these grapes, see if they grew around here, which, you know, they came out of the genetic material of this country. So they were co-evolved with Phylloxera. That's not an issue for them. And then it's, what makes a grape that makes a wine that has an interesting or a worthy flavor is kind of where all that. And then the rest is, I sometimes, I'm not seeing any facial expressions or in front of a live audience, so I can't quite gauge the humor of anyone. But I do point out to some parents that they should be careful about what books they let their children read, because for myself, I think if I had stumbled into gambling or drugs or any number of other vices, it would have been a lot simpler and cheaper.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You are growing the finest what in all of yours?
The genuses?
Yes.
Well, there, as I said, there's 27 of them. They all have Latin names, which I have never heard pronounced, so I'm really reluctant to try here. But there's about five or six of them. Estevellus is one of them, which is, I think Norton comes out of that, but there are a couple of other sister vines. But you can, we track down about 60 of these things, and you can see family resemblances of from a family to family, and a lot of them are crosses of any number of, I mean, some have one or two parentages, and some of them have five or six or seven. Labrusca, there's some of that bloodline is in some of these grapes. It tends to have kind of a reddish growing tip. And if you noticed it, when the barometer drops, the leaves will sometimes turn over and show their silvery undersides. And what's interesting about that is if you drive around Europe, you can see acres hectares and hectares of these grapes that are not vinifera. They're Labrusca, and they're living over there.
Oh, really?
There's other families that have quite a kind of like Lamanto and Manito have quite an open canopy, so you hardly have to do any canopy training there. There's Borconelia, which is where Herbamont and Lenore come from, and those have large sort of Kelly green shoots and leaves. It's you don't know these relationships when you sort of initially collect cuttings and whatnot. So the vineyard is kind of a patchwork of all these different creatures out there that are cheek by jowl against one another. But if I'd known what I know now, I probably could have arranged them all by some sort of color palette. But that's for the next generation, I guess.
These are all native grapes. You didn't do any crossbreeds or anything. These are what you have planted as native.
Well, Munson is the guy that bred, that did the crossbreeding. And I will say, what we've learned from history is that there's usually a community of people that do this. So, Munson is the easiest name to hang on that. But there are actually quite a number of Germans, most of them here in Missouri, most of them over towards the eastern side of the state, that were all engaged in breeding these grapes and in exchanging stock and so forth. There's a guy named Jacob Rommel, who's from Osage County, where I'm from, and he bred Munson bred grapes and named them after his buddies. So there's a Rommel grape, there's a Bell grape, there's a Hussmann, there's about a dozen of those. But Rommel also bred grapes, and he had one called Elvira, which is which we managed to track down, and it is the grape that is planted in the Azores. We've had a filmmaker come through who's doing a put in a plug for a film called Vitis Prohibita, which is put together by a French filmmaker, and it's about these Native American grapes and their journey over to Europe. He's doing another version, a more Americanized or American-friendly version of that same story from the American perspective, and he's heading down to Brazil in a couple of months because there are some of these that are sort of the backbone of vast regions of winemaking down there.
Wow. I never realized the American grapes have spread so far around the world.
We found old 1850s, 60s. There's a couple of these, one called Lenore, which is also called Yacas or Black Spanish. I think it was planted on all six continents, as well as Herbamont, which is, and these are both from the like 1840s. They predate Munson. But we have visited a 140-year-old vineyard of this Lenore in the Savanne. It's a in southern France. It's not really known as a wine growing region, but This is where the Cathars, I don't know if you're familiar with your various heretic sects, but they are sort of stubborn free thinkers, and I guess that translates over into the grapes that they grow.
it seems to me, well, and thought that came to mind when you were mentioning these grapes, the diseases that can get them. I mean, I'm in Florida, and Pierce disease is horrible down here on grapes. Does it affect the native grapes up there, or is it too cold?
Yeah, we're kind of north of the line.
Okay.
But Irvermont, I know, came from South Carolina. There's a lot of debate about where Lenore came from, but it's also fairly resistant to Pierce's, is my understanding. Because it's planted down in Texas quite a bit, and I imagine it's there because it is resistant. I think Lamanto is another varietal that has some acreage down there. But in the main, most of the varieties that we have, as far as I know, we're the only place that's growing them commercially.
That's the only place I know of, too. I mean, you can see them whenever you look on the different places that sell grape clippings and stock. You're the only one that has ever came up that do have the big variety of all the Native American grapes. You don't have anything that has came out of University of Minnesota or out of Cornell, have you?
No, not anymore. When I first started, we planted some vinifera, we planted some French hybrids, and then it sort of dawned on me that, the thing to focus on were these Native American grapes, so the rest went by the wayside. There's no reason, for me to engage in that if other people are doing it.
No, well, that's a good point. Yeah, you're just competing with others that are putting out the same thing all the time. You mentioned something when you started to talk about the Native American grapes, the flavor, the foxiness of it. This is something that I've always tried to explain to people what it is, and I've always described it as a mustiness. Am I wrong on that? What is a good definition of foxiness in the grapes?
Well, yeah, I think if you soaked your dog in the sink, that would be kind of it. but I want to be clear, the foxiness is associated with Labrusca, just one of those genuses. The rest are clean. So part of the missionary impulse here, like some of the varieties we have, if they had too much of that in them, they're back to the dustbin of history. I will say there are a couple that have just a wee bit, and if it's not too overbearing, it kind of is like a muscat sort of.
Yeah.
It's a pleasing. It can be nice and melon-like in light doses. But yeah, if it has that, that Conker flavor, there's no reason for us to put any energy into it.
Yeah, down here we do a lot of muscadine grapes in the southeast and all that, and the muscadine just sort of screams that foxiness to it. And whenever anybody mentions American grapes or Native American grapes, I think the mind immediately goes to the muscadine and not to all the other possibilities and all the others out there.
Right. So as I said at the beginning, that's one of our missionary goals, is to confuse people and remind them that they maybe don't know as much as they think they know. But I'm always reminding myself of that as well. So it's not just, not just me.
Well, there's so many different varieties of Native American grapes. I never realized. Like I said, I saw your podcast, and I was just totally overwhelmed by all the information you guys threw out there. And it was so interesting. Terravox Winery. Okay, you make wine from all of these different grapes separately, or do you just play with it, or what's the end game?
The goal is kind of bifurcated. Yes, we are trying to see what each of these varietals has to say. So that means it's a single varietal wines, but at the same time, we do a red blend and a white blend just to see kind of where they, where their synergy. But in order to understand what a blend is, you have to kind of understand what the ingredients are. And even within that, there's like the well, Norton is probably the grape that we have that other people grow and you know, is the most recognized. But you can make a couple of rosés out of that. One you treat as a typical reduced winemaking protocols, and the other as an oxidized thing, and they're radically different. I mean, one has the floral notes, the other one has the structure. But then if you make a wine from the must that remains, it's so thick and dark that you can pretty much stand a spoon up in it. And then it also makes a really great port. So actually a port that I think is one of the better ports that's out there. And there's one of the white grapes, Wetumpka, is that has a little bit of that muscat element to it. It's when it gets ripe, the whole vineyard smells of elderberry flowers. I mean, it's just the most floral thing. So we're really trying to figure out how to capture those aromatics. But and this is a Clark Smith's idea, actually. We because of the kind of the levels of acid and tannin in it, he thought it would make actually a white port, which we did. And damn, it's really interesting and pretty nice. And then beyond that, I'm trying to think if there's a way of saying this politely, but when we had a transition of winemakers, we'll say there was a kind of a barrel of this that was forgotten back in the corner of the cellar and for 5 years. So by the time we dug it out, the headspace was, like 60%. And before pitching it, we tasted it, and it's a wine that tastes like single malt scotch.
Wow.
It's just the damnedest thing. So we're trying to figure out the point of all that is, like, within each of these cultivars, we don't know what they're capable of. We're trying to figure that out. But the French and the, everybody else has had thousands of years to figure out what Cabernet is all about, and we've had, 10 years.
And even then, they don't know what the Cabernet is all about because there's so many different styles of that anyway. So, it's ongoing for them also. The Norton is a fascinating grape. I've had Norton. In fact, there's a winery not too far in the same county I live in here that does grow Norton and make a Norton down here in Florida, not being affected by Pierce disease, surprisingly. And he does a Norton here, makes it in a dry style and a rosé. But I've had sweet Nortons, I've had dry Nortons, I've had port Nortons. It's such a versatile grape, and it doesn't disappoint every time I've ever had it in any style. So.
And it will hang on the vine for through frost and beyond. I'm trying to figure out how to condense these stories and make them interesting to strangers. But we started this thing in 1996, and it was all a kind of a hobby that started to go off the rails. And in 2012, my accountant told me that I needed to start to actually try to, sell something if I was going to keep deducting the expenses. So that's where the commercial part of it came through. But prior to that, I was just doing this, as a hobby with the whole Tom Sawyer thing where you tell your friends it's fun to do this. And then next year you have to make new friends because they discover it's a whole lot of work. And I also have a business where I design museums on the side. So it's not like, I can go out there, through the weekend. So consequently, the Norton crop was, I think we had up to like 24 different little vintages. So you got there one Saturday and the next Sunday, and then you get a little time on Thursday. And these were all done very casually. I'm not sure I even measured bricks because what's the point? I mean, the grapes are ripe. What are you going to do about it? So you just do it. And Clark came out and made a blend of three of them and took it out to Appalachian America. And I think Dick Peterson and he and I think Gordon, someone, said that it was the best Norton, American Norton they'd ever had. So that was that was kind of encouraging. The other encouragement came a couple of years prior to that when my French wife tasted one of the Nortons and said that she would actually put that in her mouth. And anyone who knows her knows that that's about as high praise as you get. And we're thinking of maybe putting that on a label as an endorsement.
Yeah, as the French woman says, this is terrible. Oh, that's funny. I was looking at your wines. I'm on your website here. I was looking at your different wines. love your names. What, Tomka, is that a grape?
It is, yeah.
Oh, okay. And Albania. These are all the Munson varieties?
Yeah, those are. Albania, as a side note, when we went to bottle that, we were informed that we could not put that word on the label.
Oh.
It's the TTB regulations that they're trying to, defend the public, your avid listeners from fraud, as though we would have grapes from Albania. On there, and God knows. Anyway, so the word is actually printed backwards, which makes it a graphic as opposed to a word. So there you are.
I see it on the label. That I never noticed that. But that is interesting. Yes. Oh, that's funny. the TTB is always a loaded lass, isn't it?
But there's also a grape called America, and when it came time to apply for that label, they were on to us, and they said, no way. So I think the label, we just printed it without vowels. And, we have to explain what it is, but at least it's got a label.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All these names, Hidalgo, is that one of the Mumpson grapes?
It is. And one of the... Hidalgo and Wetumpka and Albania are the white grapes that I think have the most promise. But I'll mention one thing about Wetumpka, that it shatters really easily.
Oh.
And when it's ripe, you've got maybe 3 days to get out there and get that fruit, or it's going to be on the ground. And so we're discovering a couple of things, which may be the reason some of these grapes aren't too widely planted. That they have their quirks, and they can be a real pain in the patootie. But I really love that grape, so it's I don't know. You may have children like that you put up with their they shatter easily, but you deal with that.
Yeah, that's very true. I have to ask, since I had a winery in the vineyard. You mentioned the canopy and all that. Do you have to spend a lot of time on any of these grapes, training them, cutting the back on the canopy to open up? Are they susceptible to any number of diseases and I can't think of molds or anything like that?
In this climate, you really have to watch out for fungus. And as far as canopy, I think I mentioned in passing like Lamanto, Manito, some of those really open canopies, you hardly have to mess with that at all. The aforementioned Wetumpka is a very droopy kind of thing that you have to tie up. So it's a little bit of a pain. And we actually went through a couple of years of training it as a high wire, so it would just hang down, thinking that we could just reach in there and get the grapes. But and actually the yield was 50% higher than. But
wow,
just going into the vine and disturbing it to get the grapes took so much more effort, and you lost so much fruit that it's not worth it. So the ecology of growing and tending these, it's not a simple linear thing.
Oh, and so each of these different hybrids, or I can't say hybrids because they're not hybrids, each of these different grapes have their own idiosyncrasies, even more so than what you find in vinifera, it sounds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And even the fruit, I mean, there's, I think Carmen was one where at harvest it had, you know, you measure the tannins and it was a certain level, and then after it was picked, you check it the next day, and half of them aren't there. I mean, it dropped like the molecules do not go away, but they bind with proteins or they do something. I mean, the bricks and acid and all that it has a fairly understood linear curve for vinifera. Just don't play here. I mean, we were told wisely by someone when we started out here from the University of Missouri. He said, "Beware of people from afar bearing numbers." we just gotta figure it out and try this and try that, and that's why that's sort of where the TerraVox name comes from. It's the voice of the land, because we're having this conversation, and it's a very slow and lugubrious conversation, because you know every click is one season long, but eventually we'll see what they have to say.
Well, some of these, like Vignoles and Traminette's, been around. I mean, you hear of these grapes all the time.
I'll say everything in moderation, including moderation. Those are two vestiges of the original sort of very, very much more expansive planting that I just kind of like what they do. So they're the exception that proves the rule.
Okay, and then the rosés. You have what, three different rosés here that are all different colors. The Munch rosé. What grape is used in that?
Well, it's a grape named Munch, after Friedrich
really?
Munch. Yeah, Friedrich Munch. So he's one of those Missouri Germans. He came over here to found a free German state back in the 1860s. That didn't work out, but he became a Presbyterian minister, a state senator, and a friend of Munson. So they were exchanging fruit. Friedrich's brother, Richard, started Mount Pleasant Vineyards in Augusta, Missouri. Augusta being ABA number one. And that's where we got our cuttings. So, the source was like one step removed from the mothership.
Wow. Didn't recognize the name. So,
Sangnier. That's one of the Norton rosés that is made by oxidation.
Oh, okay.
So if you try that, it'll have a lot more structure than the. I think Sunny Slope is what we call the other Norton rosé.
Right.
And you. You asked if we were making wine from all the grapes. We had, I think, 37 lots last year.
Wow.
But some of them, like we're doing Wetumpka three ways, we're doing Norton four ways. And some of the vines just aren't productive yet, but there are a couple of more varietals. There's one called Volney, as in Thomas Volney Munson, that was his middle name. There's one called Ellen Scott, which is his wife's maiden name. And last rose, so those will all make rosés, but we are just on the verge of getting enough production to actually make a batch.
What do you usually get out of what's your production levels on each varietal? I mean, do you look at, okay, if I can't get 200 cases, I'm not going to make it commercially, or what is your criteria?
Oh, Lordy. We dream for 200 cases. that is also bifurcating. I mean, we are, occasionally I've given presentations at the local business school, and the basic lesson is if you, planning ahead, if you do too much of it, you would never do it. Do the thing, so stop it. Meaning, a lot of people get caught up in the spreadsheets and pro formas and all that. We began with the simple question of, do these grapes make good wine, disassociated from a business plan? But now, of course, at some point, we are working to become economically viable, which means we do have to get to the point, and we're trying to zero into about a dozen, maybe 20 varietals where we can make a barrel or a pallet enough to supply or to feed a supply chain. But there's a parallel effort, which is to keep the spirit of experimentation alive. So there's a second kind of tier, if you will, where a couple of the rows, enough to make 20, 30 gallons of something to just keep the, to feed that end of the story.
Okay. So it's the matter of trying to find ones that will be financially fruitful, but yet you're still experimenting with everything else. That's the way to do it. That sounds interesting. Your red grapes there, Lenore, that we've talked about a little bit, Lenore there. Do any of these reds have tannins? Whenever you think of Vitis vinifera, you're always thinking of the red wines, the tannins that it presents and all that. Are these Native American grapes given tannins, the acid, all the four in vinifera, or are they presenting these things differently?
They're all, well, differently, I think, is the watchword of the day. Lenore, sorry, and Norton, I think they have plenty of tannin. Some of the others, Lamanto is, we can barely get bricks up to where it's a legal wine. It still tastes good. They do tend to be a little bit shy on the bricks and hence alcohol, so they're low alcohol in the main. They're all different, and sometimes each year is different. We had a crop. You were talking about yield, the initial planting of 12 vines of each, just so you have enough to do something with. But 12 vines of Long John yielded about 200 pounds of fruit. And 12 vines of another variety called Marguerite was, maybe 12 pounds. Marguerite is, I'm afraid, not destined to be too long for our world, because that's just, we can't. I mean, we joke about the $700 bottle of wine, but it's not because it's valued that at auction. It's just that's kind of what we feel went into it.
Okay, that's interesting. Do any of these? What is the fruit size of most of these? Are these small berries? Are they rather large? I mean, the muscadine grapes themselves come out with quite large fruit. How about all these? Are they smaller or larger? What is?
Let's see. Well, I guess I could reference hailstone size. As you go from. The aforementioned, the Marguerite is then, I'd say, pea size. Norton's a little bit larger than that. And that ranges all the way up to the aforementioned Long John. There's another one called Beacon, where you're kind of marble size or shooter marble size. But most of them are regular marbles, I guess is the best reference I can think of.
So they're not real big grapes like the muscadine that.
Just two of the varieties have sort of remarkably are larger than the others size berries.
Okay. Cloeta is that a varietal grape there too? Is that one of the American grapes?
And that one, it's a really pretty grape, at least the fruit. And, this is another argument we have with Clark about, we can either say these grapes aren't like anything you've had, or we have to say these grapes are kind of like something like this so that people can find some reference point. So it's kind of a little bit of a quandary, but the Cloeta, it's got those little sort of coffee chocolate notes that is like some Merlots that I've had. Mm-hmm. But other people say, oh, this is kind of like a Pinot. So, I, you know, tastes are different. You know, one of the things I like about wine is that it's ultimately democratic in that if you like something, no one can tell you that you don't. So you sort of know everything you need to know.
No, that's very true.
There's as we are discovering, or at least I am, that there's an infinite amount of stuff you don't know. And, you know, the more you learn, the more the boundary of what you don't know seems to expand.
Yeah, all the time. It's definitely. And that's why I find it so fascinating about these Native American grapes is I never realized the range of them. Whenever I thought about them, I always thought of Muscadine, and I never pursued it any further. Go on.
Well, you're going down the street and you go to your liquor store, and there's just imagine if there were 27 liquor stores and they were all, had different lineups in there. Because every seed makes a different and unique grape. So the possibilities in there are endless, although, you know, we've lost a lot of the wild stock through cultivation and ranging and all that stuff.
That's a good point. A Serendip, is that a port style?
It is. It's so Clark is Clark consults with us, and when we run into weird situations, we'll call him up and he'll make a recommendation. And the aforementioned Lamanto that had low sugars 1 year. We called to say, what do we do with this? And I think there was an error in translation where we might have gotten like a decimal off in what to do with Lamanto. So it turned out into something that was not what we were expecting, but we, it became a port.
I made a strawberry port, and that originally because of an error too. Ooh, this would be a good strawberry port. So I pursued it that way.
It's a great thing. I mean, we have chocolate tastings here, and it's the one that is the crowd pleaser.
Oh, I can imagine it would be. Yes. Yeah. The next one here. That's the Sangie Rosé. You don't have these in order? No, you don't. let me go back to the wines. I'm bouncing around on your website here. A different ones. Okay, Stark's Star Report. Is that also a port?
It is. Stark Star was developed by a that was post Munson. It was a Professor Bachman from Arkansas that I came across an ad that was published. I don't know where, but you have a picture of Professor Bachman in his little bow tie and his derby hat and his vest, and the ad talks about the probity and the character of Professor Bachman. It doesn't say much about the grapes, but there you are. But the grapes behind them were just prodigious producers. And it was once, I understand, the foundation of the Missouri port industry. So we managed to snag 100 cuttings of that and only got one vine out of it. Because,
out of 100?
All of our stuff has to come from cuttings. Which might be an indication of, one of those quirks of this varietal just does not propagate very easily. But once you get one vine, you can layer it, but that's why it's taken 16 years to establish some of these varietals and get our 12 test plants. But Stark Star is one that we're doing even more of. There are conflicting stories about its history, whether it was purchased by Stark Brothers Nursery out of Louisiana, Missouri, and they stuck their name on it, or there's another version of some guy named Starks that adopted it. But there's all these little rabbit holes that I don't have time to run down each and every one of them. But if I find a definitive answer, I'll let you know.
Okay. I have a question. Ever since you mentioned it, I am curious about it. Design museums, is there that many new museums that are popping up around the world that you are able to design them?
In fact, it appears to be a growth industry where people are becoming aware that culture is something that needs to be defined and promulgated. So,
Oh, that's fascinating. I never considered, there are so many other jobs out there that we never consider because we never run across it, and that's one of them. I've never considered that.
Yeah, well, there's a scene from my early years, and you're there, working on putting this exhibit together, and there's a father and his daughter are happen by and look over the construction fence, and the daughter is just thunderstruck. He says, "Daddy, they make these." It doesn't occur to most people that museums are actually made by someone.
Yeah, really. I mean, and that's true. You just, every time you see it, I love museums. They're fascinating to me. And I just never thought too much about the concept of making them. It's just always, they're there. And so.
Well, it's quite interesting, and actually the French guy, when he showed up, he looked around and he said, he looked at the vineyard and he said, this is a museum. It really is. It has cultural value. It is not fiscally viable,
It really is. You don't think about it that much. A museum does not have to be walls and all that. It could be open just like the vineyard you have there with all the different varieties and everything. Are you looking at expanding, bringing in other types of grapevines that you discover them? Or are you pretty much set?
Well, I wish I was set. Like I said, we're trying to get from 60 down to 40 down to 20, but then there's a guy named Cliff Ambers who we came across, and I know he let's see, I think it was an introduction from Lucy Morton, if you know her. She's quite a known figure in the field. But anyway, he's been breeding grapes out of Virginia for these many years. So he sent us 25 varietals that he's produced. So we have a smaller test plot of his because, there's only so much you can do. So that's going on. At the same time, we're trying to narrow down and get at least the, the quote-unquote commercial acreage locked in. Because, you have to find a balance between your production and your customer base and your vineyard and all that. So we're feeling our way.
And just playing, it's always fun to play, but you gotta be commercially viable to be able to play. How many acres do you have total?
We had seven, and we are doubling to 14, but that's been a 5-year process. Because we can't just order the vines from a nursery someplace. We have to propagate all this stuff slowly. So it's definitely not a get-rich-quick scheme.
No, I didn't think about that, but you'd have to, everything that you want to replant, you'd have to get cuttings and let it root and all that other stuff. Wow, that could become.
Yeah, and at some point, my wife is going to find out what's going on, and then it's all over.
Don't forget the 17th of this month, Wife Appreciation Day. So
I made note of that.
National Day, Wife Appreciation Day.
Get her a bottle of wine.
There you go. One of her good French wines. I was going to ask you earlier, how many people you have working for you?
I'll refrain from making a joke about that. But now we have a winemaker, vineyard manager, and then we have his assistant. We have a sales and marketing person, and then we are are adding on an events person just to try to get people up here. You know, we've discovered that there's only so much you can do to entice someone online, or, you know, even through conversations like this, to actually click on and buy something. It's, they almost have to come up here and see what's going on. And then you see the little light bulb go off and they realize, you know, what it is. Because we're not selling wine so much as just the idea of exploring something that you're not familiar with. Which, and before someone, you know, embarks on that kind of course, they have to feel comfortable enough or like they know enough to sort of explore something new. So it's not a, you know, that's a whole process too. And, well, you know, and then there's, you know, some part-time and, you know, seasonal stuff to, as we need them for various times of the year and seasons.
Right. You're actually selling history. I mean, it's what you have there, Native American grapes, is something that you're not finding anywhere else. And so it's really part of the history of the country and what we've done with grapes. So many people are locked into the Vitis vinifera, and they have a hard time escaping that mindset. And I think everything that you offer is so new and different, think they know and should drink, that it's hard to break that mindset, really.
We're as I said, we're feeling our way on all these dimensions. And one is like, who's our audience? I mean, it's either people that have been around the block and are so jaded with that they're ready to try something new, or it's people at the other end of the the youth who haven't really formulated their ideas of what wine is or isn't, and are willing to explore. So, but you know, we're out there. We're trying to put out a narrative for all of them. There's also to back up to the museum thing for a little bit. There's also the particular history of the German Missourians and all these people that were corresponding with Munson, that there's a cultural history here, that whole attitude of, kind of planting a tree, even if you might not be around to enjoy the fruit, sort of
right.
Thinking systematically and long-term. That is, I like to say that this part of the world was the Silicon Valley of global viticulture at one time. The Missouri State entomologist Charles Valentine Riley is the person with Emil Plachon that figured out the whole phylloxera, that identified that bug that as the cause of the plague that was devastating the European vineyards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that. Well, being from Missouri, I've followed that story and all that. Although you talk to some Texan wineries and they swear to you that was Texas that did it, but
that can all be clarified because there's the French remember, this was at the time that Louis Pasteur was discovering the germ theory,
right?
So it was about a 7-year process for the French Academy to come around to the understanding that there was a bug that was infecting the vines. The Galen theory of medicine was that the vines were having some sort of moral failure, and that was attracting the bugs to come and attack them. So in the middle of all that, there was a guy named Thomas Viella who made a journey to the United States, and he came through, we've got a map of it somewhere, through the East Coast, visited Munson down in Texas, and Munson took him around and introduced him to X, Y, and Z. And I think Bourcanalia is one of the varietals that lives in the Chalk Hills of Texas, and that's the rootstock that he recommended that be planted in Burgundy, because those are similar soils over there. But Viala also came through Missouri and talked to Hussman and Isidore Bush and a bunch of those folks. So it's true that Munson, who was out of Texas, did send a lot of rootstock over to France, but there were boxcars and barge loads that came out of Missouri.
Oh, that much? Wow, I didn't realize that they sent that much over there. Is there a AVA in your area? And if there's not, are you going to apply for one, or what's happening with that?
Well, over on the other side of the state, there's AVA number one around Augusta, yes. Missouri. Ironically, there's a Los Hills AVA up in Iowa, north of us. Why that doesn't embrace our land, which is also Los Hills, same formation, I don't know. The rest, it's something up there on the shelf, but quite frankly, I have enough projects right now to, and getting involved with lawyers.
And you know, AVAs are nice. Say I'm in an AVA, but most people don't know what they are. I try to promote it and educate people about AVAs, but you know, most people don't know what they are and don't care. And so, if you are one, that's great. If you aren't, that's okay too. So it's not really.
Yeah, we'll limp along. If you can give us evidence that it would actually make a material difference, I'm on it. But otherwise, I got other stuff to do.
Yeah, and that's just it. I don't think it will make a difference. You know, you can say, "Oh, I'm an AVA," and then people go, "Ah, oh, what? Oh, okay." And then
that I mean, if I were to do anything like that, there's a bunch of our grapes that aren't even recognized as grapes by the TTB.
Oh, really? It's more than just a simple battle of trying to become an AVA. It's a simple battle of trying to convince the TTB that you actually have grapes there. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, it's an ontological question of existence as opposed to a nomenclature. Very, very existential. Jean-Paul Sartre probably works for TTB somewhere.
Probably. Yeah, and TTB is almost impossible to argue with, too, because they know. You know, that's just they know. And so...
certainty is a wonderful thing if you can afford it.
They know what everything is. So, well, I'll tell you, before we go, I want you to give us your email address and your website and all pertinent information. So if anybody is in your part of the country, they can find you or they can order. Oh, do you ship all over?
Oh, yeah. We have the deal with Vino Shipper, and might be one or two states that have it prohibited, but generally we can go anywhere.
Okay, good. So give us all the information. So if anybody wants to order from you or check out your website or visit you, I think I might be up in Kansas City, or Liberty, actually, the middle part of October, and I am definitely going to make a trip up to you while I'm there. Okay. So I will do that. But
website, www.terravox.wine. I'm Jerry, Jerry, terravox.wine, and the phone number is 816-354-4903. We're here humping away, so absolutely come by if you're in the neighborhood.
Do you have a Facebook page?
They do.
They do.
I have no social media accounts. I got no time for that. I don't know. I can have Michael or someone email that information to you if there's a way for you to put that out there.
Yeah, I'll put it on our Facebook page. Have him send that information, and I'll post it on our Facebook page, and let the people contact it there. And if they need to get a hold of you, Facebook, Twitter, all those things are not Twitter anymore. Is it? It's X. Any of that stuff.
I mean, ironically, everyone refers it to as X, formerly known as Twitter, which is even more syllables to pronounce.
The artist formerly known as Prince. Yeah, that's what it always reminds me of every time I see that.
Yeah, well, exactly. I guess that was Elon's role model or something.
Probably. Yeah. So you get them both. So, Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time tonight and talking about the Native American grapes and your winery and what you're doing and all that stuff. It was just as interesting as the video that you did with Stephen. And so I will.
Yeah, those guys know a lot. So yeah, it should be hopefully. Yeah. Well, Ron, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it has, and I will definitely be in touch with. Like I say, I'm going to be in Kansas City, I think, middle of October. So I will definitely take the time to come up and visit with you.
Yeah, do give advance notice.
I will.
I spend about half the time on the road with these museum projects. So there's but if I'm not here, someone else will be. But I hope to meet you when you're here.
I hope it works out that we can, and I'll look forward to it. And again, thank you so much for taking the time and talking with us today.
You betcha. Yeah. Okay. Take care.
All right. You too now. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye. All right. That was fun. That I love this Native American grapes and all the different ones available. I think I am as lost as most everyone out there is lost in the fact that when you think of Native American grapes, you think muscadine, because that's really what people are aware of. And people love the muscadine grape. Don't get me wrong. There is a big following. And every time somebody says a Native American grape, that is my thought. Not anymore, though, because there are so many others there with so many different flavors and tastes, and you don't have that foxiness that the muscadine gives. And that was always been the big turnoff for me in the muscadine grape family, is that foxiness to it. So I'm looking forward to going up there and seeing him in October. I worked as a photographer for many years, and I have a nephew and future niece that is getting married in October, and I think I might be doing pictures for their wedding. So I will be going up for that and then take a trip over to TerraVox. That should be fun. So, good interview, a lot of fun. I got one more interview to go before I post up the original interview that the webinar that they did, Northern American Native Grapes and Wines, is what the subject was. We've talked to Clark, and now we have talked to Jerry. We got one more interview with Stephen, which should be pretty soon. The reason I didn't get him any sooner, he had pneumonia, and he was having trouble talking. His voice was lost on that. He sent me an email and said that he is mending, and he should be good pretty soon here. So next contact I have with him, last one was about a week ago. Next contact I have with him, I'll get him booked. We do have a guest next week, and who is it next week? Next week, I have so many notes here, and I have so many emails with so many. The problem is with trying to check on guests. I mean, with these guys like Clark Smith and Jerry and Stephen, so their names. These are the guys I'm emailing. These are the ones I'm talking to. A lot of others are not. A lot of others are publicist or whatever you want to call them. These are the people who are trying to get on different shows, interviews, and stuff like that. So I am trying to always find out who this person is or that person. I'm going to have to find out and let you know. Hang on. I've got it written down here. Where is it? I've got all these things spread out all over the place here. And I don't know where everything is. Here it is. Okay. Next week is going to be the 14th. Okay. So October? No. September. September 14th. There we go. Gino is going to be our guest. There we go. Gino is... Oh, okay. California Wines. We talked to Allison, what was it, a month ago about sustainability and climates. And Gino's going to talk to us about his topics of discussion. He has different things that he is more learned in, and so we will talk with him. They also, California Winery, the California Wines has festivals, wine festivals, and different things that they have scheduled around the state. And so the rest of this month and going into October, so he's going to talk to us about that too. So next week will be Gino Dicaro, D-I-C-A-R-O, will be our guest from California Wines, and should be an interesting interview then. So again, once more, thank you, Jerry. It was a very enjoyable interview. Had a good time and learned some stuff. And thank him for that. And we'll come back next week. Don't forget, 17th, National Wife Appreciation Day. And we'll see all of you next week on All About Wine. Be safe out there. And thanks for listening.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.